And at the Fox was waiting and waiting and waiting, and then there was an introduction and great applause, and we all welcomed James Lowe to Spokane, and now welcome James Lowe to Greater Spokane via the airwaves of KPBX.
Thank you, Vern. It's fantastic to be here.
Yeah. And I want to start with a bit of a different take on your autobiography, maybe, and that is that sometime in the last couple of months, you got a phone call saying, well, we had that process and we had finalists, and we'd like to invite you to become the music director of the Spokane Symphony. And something like that is a fork in the road for somebody at some point. You had a perfectly fine life with orchestras and busy musician, but all of a sudden, now there is this one. And so talk about kind of what you were thinking about all the way on the plane from Edinburgh to here and what this really means inside you.
Well, the first thing is when I came here in February, I came with a very open mind and I thought I'll just be myself and do what I do and we'll see how it is. And then when I started working with the orchestra, from the first second, I just realized this is something very special. I mean, I knew obviously the organization was incredible. You have this incredible hall. But the chemistry with the orchestra is just not something you can predict or control. It just is either there or it isn't. And from that moment on, I thought, I went from being like, hey, this would be a nice gig, to I would love this job. I would really love this job. And so then I was, of course, anxiously waiting because I was the second guy up. And so it's a long, long wait from middle of snowy February until I got the call. And so I got, you know, Jeff sent me an email, said, can we talk? I was in Finland at the time, and there was a time difference, so it was late in the evening there. And I was in my hotel room waiting for the phone to ring, and he rang, and he said, well, you know, we've decided, we were looking at things, and I thought, oh, well, it's somebody else. And he said, so you're our choice, and we just want to get a few. So I you know, it's like the bit when Wile E. Coyote is chasing Roadrunner, and Roadrunner stops, and he just goes screaming past. I was like, what? Sorry, let's just go back. Oh, right, okay, I'm the guy. Oh, wow. And then we had, I mean, then of course we had to discuss a few things. So we actually all met in New York in May to talk about the details and to find out whether this could actually fit in the schedule, I could give enough here, and whether what I could do here would be interesting for me. And it was a very short meeting. You know, we chatted, and they said we'd like this, and I said, well, I can give you that, and I said, well, I'd like this, and they said, that's what we want to give you. So that was it. So it's been really amazing, and since that moment, it's been a bit of a whirlwind. The hardest thing was keeping my trap shut and not telling everyone. So I told a few very close friends, but I said, nothing on Facebook. You have to keep it top secret. So it's just been a real whirlwind since finding out. And now I'm just making many, many lists. Yeah. My phone is full of lists.
Yeah. Well, a few sentences ago, you said how it would work for me. And so talk about that again, kind of just from your musical life and love and career and how this fits in.
Well, I think that I'm very passionate that I start from the perspective that classical music is for everybody. Mm. And everybody, I always say, if you've got a pair of ears and a beating heart, you can understand classical music. That's all you need. You don't need a great education. You don't need to be a specialist in musicology. You can just listen and it will talk to you. And I have a feeling that there's a lot of symphony orchestras who go around and their job is to generate concerts. Like, the orchestra is a machine for generating concerts. And I don't agree with that. I think, of course, the subscription series is the core of what an orchestra does. But it's also about what's your engagement with the community, what's your education program like, how are you reaching out to new people? And these are all things that have been done historically here very well indeed. And this idea, frankly, that you can come here as the music director and say, okay, I want to do this. This is something I'm really passionate about. And rather than say, oh, we don't do it that way in Spokane, they say, okay, let's do it. Let's figure out how we can make that work. So for me, it's just fantastic because you can really, it's an orchestra, I think, that really makes a difference in the town.
And yesterday, when you were taking questions from the audience, you took on part of that, certainly that question about all you need is two ears and a beating heart, and talked a little bit about that, and then you said, and knowing that it was a big public event, you said, well, we should have coffee sometime and get into it. Okay, you got a drink in your hand. I got a drink in your hand. We're now having that coffee.
Sure.
Let's really repeat a little bit of that concept of kind of the human psychology relative to classical music, but then let's really get farther inside this wonderful missionary project we have.
Well, I think classical music has somehow found itself with a bit of a bad, not reputation, but a bad image. It's kind of become a little bit, in some people's minds, like it's a one percenter activity, like owning a yacht. Mm-hmm. It's like something I don't do. You know, that's for the very, 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 very wealthy people, or the people who've got a very in-depth liberal arts education. Like, if you have a PhD in musicology, then it's for you. And I think that's all total nonsense. I think classical music is really something that everybody can enjoy. And, you know, we have this thing where Beethoven lived through some incredibly difficult things in his life and struggled and overcame them. And that's something we can all identify with. We've all had those moments where we've really struggled, and I think listening to Beethoven always fills me with hope. If I'm having a horrible time and I listen to something of his, it always ends on a note that makes me think, okay, well, we can do this. And you feel with this music that someone has been there before you. So that's where I start from, is that this music really talks to people, and that the problem is not one of the content of what we're doing. It's the kind of the image that people have in their minds. It's not an image that the Spokane Symphony Orchestra creates, but it's something that in the general public. So, like I always say, if you watch an episode of Frasier, you know, great sitcom, but always his taste in music was always like a little cipher for how uptight he was and how uber refined, you know. And that's, in general society, I think that's how we're seen. So part of my job, I think, is to break down those barriers. And in terms of engaging new audiences, I think, you know, something we've done in Finland that's been very successful is try to create concerts that work as a bridge into what I would call the kind of subscription series. Here's the masterworks. So what's the pathway to take someone from, I don't know, say Harry Potter or a Comstock Park gig? What's the pathway that takes them through to being a Masterworks subscriber at the other end, or a donor? And these are things that I'm really interested in. So one thing we've been doing in Finland is bringing in an element from that is not normally found in the concert hall. Like, we had a local author who collects folk stories from that region, and she came and she read out some of these, and we found pieces that reflected those and weaved them around her stories. Or we had a couple of friends of mine who are incredible Scottish folk musicians came, and we did a gig exploring how classical music has been influenced by folk music. And we played Lutosławski and Bartok and Dvorak, as well as some of their really kind of banging tunes, you know. Mm-hmm. And the idea is we play proper, serious subscription-style repertoire, but with an element that is not normally found in the concert hall. So people come for one thing, and then they hear, oh, hey, quite like that Bartok, or I quite like that Lutosławski. I'm gonna come again, and then you will find that the next week is a sellout because we've got these people who have been introduced in a way that we've not sold them something we don't do, we've not dumbed it down, but we've shown them actually how exciting and how relevant this music is to them.
And the one thing that reminds me of that sense of what seems to be a lot of people that really get it on music is that lovely scene we get to watch, and so we'll bring your accent into this, the last night at the Proms, when you have 8,000 people or whatever fits into Royal Albert Hall, all singing Land of Hope and Glory together. And right now I get chills up and down my spine even thinking about that. Is there any of the, what's going on there? Is there any of that that we could hope for and appropriate? Would that be, is there any correlation there?
I think so. So I have a theory about the Proms, which is that one of the problems that classical music faces is it's a little bit like we have a ritual space. It's like a church or a synagogue, and there are rules for how you behave. And for someone who doesn't come, they maybe don't know the rules. And sometimes people are made to feel a little bit inadequate if you turn up wearing the wrong thing. You know, am I going to turn up in the wrong clothes? Am I going to clap in the wrong place? I really don't care about any of that. You can dress how you like, and you're not going to applaud in the wrong place, because if you're the first time concert goer, you're never going to be the first guy in. You know, you're always just going to wait and see what other people do. So I think one of the big things with the proms is that half the audience are standing up for the whole concert. So the way it works, you have this huge arena, and the Albert Hall is this massive barn of a place. It's like, it used to be called the Nation's Village Hall. And it's actually a terrible concert venue because it's too big.
Yeah.
So you've got the orchestra at one end of this huge oval, and there's seating around the side, but for the proms, and that's what proms means, to promenade, to walk around, you can buy on the day a standing ticket for like $5 or $6. And you can stand and listen to all the world's great orchestras. And so the actual festival of the proms lasts the whole summer. And every night, if not twice a day, you get a great orchestra or ensemble playing great music. And you can listen to the whole thing for five at a time. And so there's something about this idea that they're standing up. It's not a concert hall feeling venue. You're in like a communal space. So one thing I think is really interesting for orchestras to explore is, what other spaces can we take? Not to say the Fox is not a great space. Of course, it's stunning. But are there other places where we can go which dissolves that question of formality? Say, okay, no, come in. We're going to stand up, have a drink in your hand. It doesn't matter. We're going to chat to you, and we're just going to play this great music. And I read, there's some people that get really annoyed about this. I read an article. There was a Baroque group that go around pubs and play Baroque music in pubs. And there was a letter to the editor saying, how dare they demean this great music by playing it in a pub? And I thought, why not? If you don't want to hear classical music in a pub, don't go to the gig. Go and hear it in the concert hall. It's fine. So I think that the secret of the proms, there's something in there about, it's a venue that everybody thinks is theirs. And they feel that everybody has permission to enter. There's no barrier to entry. So I think actually here in Spokane, the Fox has that feeling. You know, this is a venue that belongs to everybody here. And the acts that you get here, it's not just the symphony place here. We have, you know, Art Garfunkel plays when it's not raining too hard, you know. And so that feeling is, you know, I'm comfortable in the space, and so I'll be comfortable going to the symphony. I think it's a huge advantage for us.
I'm speaking with James Lowe, the new music director of the Spokane Symphony. And so there's vibe, there's setting, there's comfort level, there's opening people to music. And as you've already alluded, that's traditionally done well here already. Are there other ways to open people to music that you have in the back of your mind that you're going to try to really get people's brains just in the right open, or their ears and their hearts in the open receptive space?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a ton of things. It's a whole matrix of what you're doing. There is no silver bullet. Everybody, I think, has been searching for the big answer. You know, what's the one low hanging fruit thing we can do that we've missed? You know, I like to think we're kind of smart people running these outfits, and nobody in the world has quite cracked that nut. So perhaps it's a bit more complicated than that. But it's a whole matrix of what you do. I think one of the things I see my role is as someone who's approachable, and I want to talk to people. If somebody sees me in the street, I want to have a chat with them. If they say, you know, why should I come to the symphony? I'll tell them. Or one of the things we're hoping to do is something, again, I've done before with other orchestras, is like a kind of book group setting. So I'll just turn up with a cup of coffee. We'll sit there, and anything from 10 to, you know, sometimes four or five people, doesn't matter. We'll just sit there and we'll talk about the program for that week. I'll talk about how I put it together, how we're rehearsing it, what it means, like get into the weeds of it, not in a really technical, musicological analysis kind of way, but, you know, like with the Copeland that's coming of Masterworks 1, you know, how does music sound American? What makes music sound American? Well, let's get into that. Let's talk about it. Let's hear their ideas. We'll chat about it. So I think this idea of just being someone who people get to feel comfortable with, I think it's very important in the role I'm in. But like I say, overall, there's so many different factors in this. You know, I think we've all, if we're classical music fans, we've all been to concerts that I'm not talking about in Spokane, but we've all been to concerts that have been technically brilliantly played but quite boring. So I think there's also an element of risk that we have to take as musicians on the stage. And that can be really uncomfortable for the players. You know, this idea of flexibility and a little bit of improvisation, you know, it keeps things alive and aflame. But these are all ingredients in the right mix. And yeah, the job here now is to continue this fantastic work that's already been going on. It's not like, you know, I'm coming in as music director and thinking, oh, thank God, you know, that's I can really change things, because there's so much going on here that's wonderful. It's about now, okay, now what's next?
Now, a variant on the usual questions you get asked about repertoire, you know, you and I have both hated to answer that question, what's your favorite piece, so I won't ask that one. But maybe some delicious surprises you have for us. Are there some personal favorites that maybe we don't know about that in upcoming years you'll lead us into, or some unique specialties you have, you know, within the orchestral repertoire?
Well, there certainly are. I mean, I think first thing to say is that putting together a season program is a 3D chess game. Mm. And I love when you have individual programs that kind of the pieces speak to each other. They somehow influence each other, but also threads that link the whole season together. So that's one of the really kind of, that's when I really nerd out. Mm-hmm. my squares of flashcards, you know, right? Mm-hmm. There, you know, so I was up very early this morning, and I was looking at the database that I was sent yesterday of everything that the orchestra's performed since they started taking records and when they last did it. And I was going through, and I've been making a long list of all the pieces that I really would love to do here. And I was thinking, oh, this piece, and looked, and yep, done it. Rats. So the repertoire here has been incredibly broad. I mean, there are a couple of gems. There is a piece that I discovered through a horn player friend of mine in Scotland, who rang me up very excitedly and said, have you heard Cherepnin's Overture to the Distant Princess? And I said, I have not heard this piece. And she said, listen to it. And I listened to it, and I immediately programmed it. It's stunningly beautiful. So it's high romantic Russian music, lovely overture, great concert opener. So I'll definitely be having that in.
Nice.
And then at the other end, you know, I was looking the last time, I mean, you've performed Mahler 9 here, but not for a while. And that is a piece that it's one of those pieces that changes you. It's had a profound effect on me as a person. And it's a piece that I work closely alongside with Heitink. I was his assistant in Amsterdam when he was performing that. And he thought at the time it would be the last time he would perform it. He actually subsequently went on 3 or 4 years later to do it again. But now he's retiring this year. He's doing his last concerts this summer, and then he's stopping. And so that moment for me to work on that piece and to see him shape that piece with that great orchestra was a profoundly moving one for me. So I am itching to perform that.
Yeah, if I can stop you there, because we have that lovely old Philips set of Concertgebouw Heitink doing Mahler, I think, before the world had even caught on to it, because it's a long time ago. Talk a little bit more about Heitink and Mahler and what you learn.
Oh, well, I mean, Heitink and Mahler and that orchestra, it's an incredible combination, because, of course, Mahler was very closely connected with Mengelberg and conducted the orchestra himself. And so the Mahler tradition in Amsterdam is deep. It goes right to the roots of that composer. And Heitink, obviously, I think, is one of this kind of unbroken chain from that era. And the combination of that orchestra and him in that hall is something magical, because he doesn't talk a lot. He doesn't talk about colors and things. It just emerges. And I studied with him a little bit. I did a masterclass with him in Lucerne many years ago now. And he's very humble, and he would say, a student would be conducting, it was a good orchestra, and he'd say, oh, I can't quite explain, but can I just show you? And he'd take the baton and do something with his incredible focus, and the sound would emerge, and it would sound like the Concertgebouw Orchestra was sitting there, you know. And I don't know how he does it. I have my theories, but it's a little bit of magic. And so he's a very, very special human being. And I think you hear in people's music making You hear whether they're doing it for their ego or whether they're doing it for ulterior motives or whether they're kind of slightly shallow people. I think you really, really hear that in their music making. With him, it's all about the music. He said in an interview I read recently, somebody said about, oh, Maestro Haitink, what about your interpretation of Brahms? And he said, he got annoyed. He said, why do we always have to talk about interpretation? Why can't we just play the music? And I love that. I just think it's fantastic. So, you know, conducting, of course you've got to have an ego to do it. Of course, you know, we all have egos. Otherwise, we couldn't stand up in front of a group of 70 pairs of eyes.
And tell them what to do.
And tell them what to do. But having said that, the way he approaches making music, it's all about the music and all about the composer and very little about him. And I find that really deeply inspiring.
And as long as we're talking about people, maybe beyond the music and into the way music relates to people, what did you learn from Benjamin Zander?
Ah, well, Ben Zander is an absolute force of nature. He plucked me out of it. I did a masterclass with him, and he rang me up a few weeks later and said, what are you doing in September for a year? And I think I answered morning or afternoon. And they invited me over, and they made this kind of... I was the first international Zander fellow. They'd done it one a year before for Jimmy Gaffigan. And they brought me over. He is an incredibly inspiring guy. If you don't know who he is, Google Benjamin Zander and look at his TED talk, and you'll see exactly what he's talking about. Huge amount of energy. The way he approaches music was utterly new for me. The way he thinks about phrasing and shaping of music and freedom within music. His big thing is that we play very differently as a big orchestra than we did when we're playing chamber music on our own. The chamber music is free, and suddenly you have 70, 100 people, and it becomes stiff. And how can you play it freely? And that has been a huge influence on me, and I think he's right. And also the idea of hundreds of ideas, but another great gem of his is tempo. And say that the slow movement of Eroica, the metronome marking is quite fast. And if you play it at the metronome mark with a lot of impulses per bar, it sounds very fast. But if you play it at the metronome mark with one impulse per phrase, it sounds incredibly slow. So it's these... He gave me so many insights, not least into the power that music really has to inspire people and change people's lives.
Spending time with James Lowe, the new music director of the Spokane Symphony. And let's finish, not finish, we have lots more to talk about, but one more person to talk about. Because of the year you spent in Boston, did you have any interface with Günther Schiller?
I sadly did not. I met him briefly. A friend of mine was his assistant for a long time. It was shortly after that The Complete Conductor came out, his amazing book.
And so you've had to face down that book.
I've had to face down that book. And I have to say, one of the most terrifying things about coming here in February was that I knew obviously that Günther had been the music director here. Yeah. And I, you know, for those of you who don't know, he's a previous music director, an incredible musician. I mean, on a level that exceeds most of humanity. And he wrote this book, which is a tirade against conductors. And it's thick. It's really thick. And there was
it names names,
and he doesn't hold back. And there is an entire chat. He goes through. The first part of the book is about telling everybody why conductors are such terrible people. And then the second half of the book is him going through individual pieces, note by note, and pulling them apart and showing you what the composer was doing on an incredible high level. And so I had read this book and had gone through his Brahms 4, and I thought, oh Lord, this orchestra must have played, there'll be people in this orchestra who played Brahms 4 with Schiller. And I was thinking, oh God. And then I asked Celeste, the librarian here, for a set of Boeing masters. So I just wanted to see the Boeings that were going to be used. And she sent me over it. She scanned them and sent them by email. And I opened them. And the first thing I saw was a phrasing mark, an initials GS underneath it. And I thought, oh, Lord, they're even playing from the same parts that he used. So I came in. I mean, I was so nervous about that because the bar there had been set very high. And his understanding of the music was so deep. it's quite a sobering thought.
I assume you went through and said, oh, now that's pretty good Wyoming. I see why we should do maybe it that way.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of bangs that I changed, but
of course.
But actually, the Boeings, though, they were using were not entirely his. They had changed a few of them in the years following. The way he analysed music was just astonishing. Yeah. And that was a huge inspiration, reading that book and meeting him. Although, as I say, I met him, but it was only brief. Then sadly he died, and I never really got to sit down with a beer and have a proper conversation with him.
Yeah, it was a great gift that we had him so much. It was extraordinary time for Spokane. You and I were earlier talking about unique, wonderful things about Spokane, and one of them was having Gunther here, not only doing the symphony, but doing the jazz orchestra and doing the Bach Festival.
Yeah,
the many sides of him.
And it must have been terrifying as a horn player. It must have also been quite...
No, it wasn't terrifying because he knew what it felt like, and so it wasn't terrifying at all.
Yeah.
But I be indulgent for a minute. One of the amazing things is that we took on a project and we did the Miles Davis Porgy and Bess stuff that he had played the original session on.
Wow.
And then the parts had been lost, and he recreated the parts. And then we did it with him, and I got to play on it. And it was like being in New York in 1953 or something. It was to have that touchstone. But I digress. One other kind of general thing I want to talk about is that each conductor has kind of an orbit of your world and the people you know relative to soloists. And certainly Eckhart had those. Talk about your orbit of soloists that you're aware of.
Well, I've been lucky, very lucky, to work with some incredible people over the years. Because I've worked in loads of different places and worked with many, many different people. And so I always think there are soloists who are... world names, you know, household names around the world. And then there are soloists who are very well known and respected. And then there are soloists who are totally unknown who are astonishing. So I like the idea of being able to bring a kind of range of those. One person, I haven't spoken to him about it yet, so I probably shouldn't talk out of turn, but I come from the city of Nottingham in England, as there's a fantastic cellist, Sheku Canny-Mason. And
he's the big deal.
He's the big deal now
in the UK right now.
Yeah, he's everywhere. So he was the guy. For those of you who don't know, he played at the Royal Wedding, and
a young African
British.
Yeah. What term do you use?
Well, just black. I mean,
yeah,
I guess.
Black,
but
yeah.
they are an incredible family. They are, I think, six or seven children, and they all play incredibly high level. I've worked with two of his sisters, who are both pianists. One of whom, Isa, has just signed with Decca and has just brought out her first recording, which is the Clara Schumann Piano Concerto. So I would love to get those two out here. And I know, in fact, Sheku's American debut was in Seattle a year ago, a year and a half ago, something like that.
Certainly.
So I would love to get him and Isa and you know, get them involved. It's just the way he makes music is totally natural. He's one of these people. He's a very soft-spoken guy, but the minute he has a cello in his hand, he speaks from the depth of his soul. It's quite remarkable. So I think you know, there's a lot of young soloists that get fired up to the top of the mountain very early on in their career, but he's one that I think really has something to say.
Nice. Spending time with James Lowe, the conductor of the and music director of the Spokane Symphony. We don't have to put any extra adjectives on that. It's just now what who you are and what you are and what you're going to be doing, as you'll be here, I presume, for the Comstock concert and then the opening concert of the season.
Unfortunately, I won't be conducting Comstock this year because of prior engagements. Because
I
only found out in May. But the first concert I'll be doing with the orchestra is the Masterworks 1.
Okay, so we'll certainly have you then, which is just right in the middle of September, and encounter you then. So what a treat. Throughout the next year and the next many years, we'll hear many great pieces conducted by James Lowe. Welcome to Spokane.
Thank you, and look forward to it.